big rocks and all that sort of thing.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We're back. Someone's left the back door open.
They have
born in a barn.
Lovely view of the toilets. Where Mick's just explaining great detail what he's been doing.
No. Now then, I hope you're all suitably refreshed. No? Yeah. Answer me when I talk to you. Did you all manage to have a very small sherry? Liars. Right, we're on to the really special part of the show. I'd like you all, please, to make an enormous amount of noise and welcome to the stage the one and only Mr. Stephen Wilson.
Thank you very much.
I'm in the wrong place.
So, Stephen, tell us about Marillion.
Oh, harmonic. Yeah.
Well, apparently you've got 6 questions and 5 of them are about Marillion.
Well,
that's John.
Three questions and 2 of them were about Marillion.
Can we just keep it? I'll answer one about Marillion. About that. That's the deal I'm going to make with you. One okay. question about Marillion.
Okay.
Oh, but before we get into that,
yeah.
Stephen, we're delighted to have you here. Thank you so much for coming.
Likewise, thank you.
The last we heard from you in terms of your music and putting stuff out was that incredible Christmas single, December Skies. Can you tell us a little bit about that story? Because you rang
yes.
before Christmas and said you'd done a Christmas song, which we hadn't seen coming. So tell us about that.
So I certainly hadn't seen it coming out. So I was challenged by a very good friend of mine, basically, to do something that you would never imagine I would do. I mean, I'm not known for my cheery songwriting, let's face it. So a very good friend of mine, Jonathan, said, we were a little bit worse for wear one evening. He said to me, why have you never done a Christmas song? And I sort of laughed. And then I said, I thought, I could do the music, but the one thing I could never pull off, I could never write lyrics that would be suitably Christmassy. He said, well, it's okay. He whipped out his phone. He said, it's okay, we'll get AI to do it for you. I'd never really explored the whole ChatGPT thing before, but he wrote into his phone, write Christmas lyrics in the style of Stephen Wilson. And instantly it produced this song. Now, the first time it wasn't quite right, but that we saw, and you know, we started to adapt. We're saying, okay, make it not about, don't mention Christmas, make it more kind of, you know. And each time it would generate these, and I was just blown away, and I thought, okay, well, I've got to do it now. So the last lyrics that it produced were the ones for December Skies, and I went home and I recorded it. Now, this was just a couple of weeks before Christmas, so we were very short notice, but I think next year we're going to try and put it out properly as a physical thing, because it came out great, you know.
It's a great song.
Yeah, it came out really good, and even the video was AI generated. It's crazy.
Oh,
yeah.
I haven't seen the video. What's that like?
Well, it's basically like it's been fed all of my videos and it's come up with a kind of generic Stephen Wilson AI video. And that's exactly what it looks like, but with a Christmas sort of theme to it. It's amazing. It's amazing.
One of the readers that is here tonight, Lee, who's over there, was listening to the pod where John and I were talking about this. Because you rang me, we were talking about it, remember? Mm. And Lee, because we were also joking about a story that took me 2 weeks to finish. It's only a 500-word article on the Last in Line album by Ronnie James Dio. And I just couldn't do it. I was busy with other things. It became a standard joke. Have you written it yet? Have you written it yet? And I eventually said, I should do what Stephen did and write it on an AI in the style of Mick Wall, and then forgot all about it. But this chap over here actually did it and sent it to me. And I have to say, it's scary. Really
it's
fucking
not
good.
Scary. It's not
bad. I was reading it thinking, it's better than me. I don't know about in the style. Well, I mean, it actually wasn't in my style.
No, it wasn't. I mean, the slightly alarming thing is the only way it can work is if someone has, you know, trained the AI with your lyrics. So someone has pumped your catalogue in there at some point.
But as I understand it, I mean, I don't know, maybe this gentleman knows more about it than I do, but as I understand it, the whole thing with ChatGPT is it takes all the information on the internet and it kind of feeds it into its own sort of melting pot. So it can access anything on the internet. So it can access all of Mick's existing
writing.
It does,
but I think sort of slightly more sinisterly, it's been fed with, you know, books and albums and those sorts of things. Outside
Possibly.
Of copyright, yeah. Well, it certainly has with books. So that's how it can do. I mean, it probably haven't put your books in yet.
Right.
They
probably haven't put your books in yet. They haven't got round to it.
Well, it's a very far too elevated, John. You see, in 10 years when they've caught up.
But once they put your books in, it will come out in the style of Mick Wall, as you know. That's.
But would you consider doing just as a musical experimental? Because I'm thinking of here, like, you know, when Bowie did Cut Ups and. Mm. Which isn't a million miles away, but just obviously pre-computer age.
Right.
Would you consider doing an album, EP, not just a Christmas song, but actually some proper work?
As an experiment, yeah, sure. I mean, I'm fascinated by it. I mean, the whole point is this isn't going away. It's not going away. Now, an interesting thing about the Christmas song is my label, Virgin, it's part of Universal. I went to them and I said, I've done this Christmas song. Can we release it on Spotify? And they said, no, we have a policy. Universal have a policy. We will not handle anything that's been generated by artificial intelligence. To which the obvious retort to that is, officially, I bet all of your artists, you know, whether they admit it or not, I bet all of them are, well, not all of them, but I'm sure a lot of them are using it as a tool. They're just not telling you.
Yeah.
And I'm actually being the honest one. I'm saying the lyrics were written by AI. So because of that, they wouldn't handle it. They won't handle it.
But what, for copyright reasons?
I think they're worried about the whole copyright thing. Like who, you know, but the whole thing about, you know, these songs where they can take Freddie Mercury's voice. And
yeah, but that's not what you did, is it?
Well, it's the same ballpark, isn't it? But I suppose the idea is that the AI wrote the lyrics. They wrote them in the style of me. So you get into this kind of weird kind of like loop in the way you think. Well, okay, can ChatGPT sue me because it wrote the lyrics? But it wrote the lyrics based on my lyrics. So can I sue the ChatGPT for suing me? Do you know what I mean? So you get this kind of weird...
But for me, it would have been a great selling point because sooner or later, someone's going to do it and they're going to go, amazing, this innovative artist has done his new album using AI. And it will be a talking point, especially if it's any good. You know, December Skies was great.
I think it came out great, yeah. And hopefully it will still be a talking point next Christmas, which is when, you know, it was such short notice. I wish I'd kind of thought of it, a couple of months earlier. We could have made a big deal out of it. Yeah. But this Christmas we're going to try and... Because I'm actually really proud of it, you know.
It's a great track.
It works as a Christmas song. It really does.
When you said to me, what do you think of it? I was nervous to tell you how much I liked it because I thought you might be offended.
Yeah. No, not at all.
In some way, you know, because
it's
way
better than all that other
stuff. Yeah. Best thing you've done in years, mate.
Best lyrics, anyway. No, I mean, I'm really proud of it. The beautiful thing about it is a Christmas song, but it sounds completely like me.
Yeah.
So I mean, I mean, when you write, I don't know fully what your process is, but when you get into that stage of an album where things are starting to tail off, where you're thinking, I've got 40 minutes, but I really need 45 or whatever, do you find, have you always got the music and you're thinking about lyrics and trying to find lyrics, or is it the other way around, or...
Lyrics is the hardest thing.
So you can find yourself reaching, you know, the temptation could be, I've got week to finish this, you know.
So I'm very good at generating enormous amounts of music with no idea what the vocal melodies are going to be, with no idea what the lyrics are going to be, and then painting myself into a corner. Because the thing is, I can hear in my head amazing vocals, and then I find I'm very limited as a singer, unfortunately. Then I find I can't sing what I heard in my head.
AI could probably sort you out. With
yeah, probably. So a lot of music kind of just ends up gathering dust because I haven't been able to find a way in.
And now you think, if I just use the AI lyric, I'll have an album out by tomorrow morning.
So maybe that's what you're talking about. Yeah. Maybe that's where the EP comes in, yeah.
Well, I, on a serious note, I could imagine, say, Bowie back in the day doing something like that, or Eno, or all the sort of people that, as an artist, I see you...
The curious people. Neil Young, sort of, people that are curious about technology, you know, and how it's changing the way music right. is made. And that continues. And I think the interesting thing, obviously, is for a lot of people from the tradition of rock music, this is a very scary development. But why is it any more scary than the invention of, you know, the mellotron or the electric piano or the sampler? It's just the next level in terms of things that facilitate the creative process. It's a tool. I think people are worried that the AI will just make the music and there won't be any need for musicians anymore. And that is a possibility. But I think as a creative tool, it's exactly the sort of thing that Bowie would have been fascinated with, or Neil Young, yeah.
And also, pop music these days is so formulaic. You know, you've got half a dozen songwriters credited because one of them came up with the bridge, or one of them... What was it? Change a word, get a third, you know?
Right.
That stuff already exists. We already have, if you like, AI-generated formulaic production line, very, very successful pop music. The people that write for Taylor and Britney and all those people. But if an artist like you does it, it immediately isn't that. It's something more interesting. So,
well, hopefully, yeah. I mean, I think that's the whole thing, really, at the end of the day, using technology, it's about investing it with your own personality and putting your own stamp on it. And if your personality is strong enough, then you transcend all of this, you know, AI stuff. At least I like to think December Sky still sounds like me, you know.
Oh, it does.
Yeah, okay.
It really does. Very much in the style of it.
Yeah. And like we say, it's inspired by me in the first place. So how does that work? I don't know. It's interesting. It's a fascinating time.
It is. Well, we kind of started off with this idea about talking a little bit about the studio and so on. Obviously, you're kind of... And the first thing someone shouted out was, "Your studio's in your shed." Are they right?
I think they said garage.
Oh, garage. Sorry, yes. Garage. Right. No. Then we said you've probably got a shed as well.
And then we said so two could, sheds.
Yeah. If you could clarify the shed
at least
situation.
Two. No. But this gentleman is right. My studio is in my garage. It looks like a garage from the outside. It's been renovated and turned into. It's a double garage, to be fair. It's been turned into a studio space. Yeah, just before COVID, luckily. I moved into a new house with my wife just before COVID, spent a few months creating the studio space. COVID came along and I essentially disappeared into that studio for 2 years. I don't know what I would have done otherwise because obviously couldn't tour, couldn't see anybody. And I produced a lot of music and did a lot of remixes. And yes, it is in my garage, yeah.
But that notion that we were talking about of, you know, when you grew up in the same sort of era as us, where the studio had this kind of mythic quality, you know, you'd know the names of them and you'd want to go to them. Did you not have that? Did you not think, oh, I'd love to be in Hamza, or I'd love to be in the Def Leppard studio or something like that?
Yes and no. I never enjoyed the pressure of being in a commercial recording studio, because I'm the kind of person that likes to be able to spend a week programming a hi-hat pattern and then decide it doesn't work and throw it away. Now, if you've just spent 20 grand programming that hi-hat, the rest of the band are going to give you a hard time. Do you know what I mean? So I never responded well to that kind of being on the clock. At the beginning of my career, we did the first album I ever made with a professional, you know, kind of budget and a record company underwriting it. We spent a lot of money in a lot of big studios, and I didn't enjoy it because everything we did, I felt like, wasn't quite as I would like it.
But
we ran out of time.
How much was that budget?
I think the first album I did was this band called No Man. We must have spent about 150 grand making a record. And, you know, but that's a small budget. In those days, that was a small budget. But we, I mean, it doesn't take a lot of studio time to rack up that kind of bill. I think we probably did about 2 months in, we were in a studio called Jacobs in Farnham for a few weeks. I think we were in Rockfield for a couple of weeks in Wales. So it doesn't take an awful lot of, you know, it's like £1,500 a day, you know. So it doesn't take a lot. It doesn't take a lot of studio time to rack up a big bill very quickly. And I never responded well to that scenario. And I knew right from the very beginning I have to be able to get my own studio together so that I can just disappear up my own rectum. If I want to, just disappear up my own posterior. And that's the way I've made records ever since. Up my own anus. So, loving every minute of it.
Yeah. So, oh yeah, yes, up his anus.
Yes.
You were saying just now, rectum gags work.
Scatology, yeah.
There you go. There you go. So, where are you right now, Stephen? In terms of what you do next, because over the last year or two, we had a Porcupine Tree album for the first time in, I'm going to say, 15 years, something like that, 12, 13
years.
Yeah,
something like that, yeah.
No scatology needed. And also, of course, your solo album came out last year, and your latest solo album came out last year. So where are you now with I mean, what's your next move?
Well, I've almost finished the next one. People say to me, you never stop, do you? I can preempt somebody saying that. But actually, I finished the Harmony Codex December 22. So, you know, that's, I think that's one of the things that's changed in the industry now is, you know, you guys, I'm sure you guys talk about a lot, you know, a lot about the 70s and the 80s. The climate for rock music then was you go into the studio, you cut a record, 6 weeks later, it's out. Doesn't happen that way anymore.
No.
Unless you just want to dump it on Spotify or Bandcamp or something. And people do that. But the time between writing, making a record, mixing and mastering it, and the actual release just seems to get longer and longer and longer and longer. And it's frustrating because I like to move quite quickly. And as you know, I like to do different things and, you know, take each product, each record as a sort of springboard for doing something different to the next. So that 9 month period between finishing the Harmony Codex and the album coming out. So by the time the album's out, I'm ready to do the next one. Mm. So that's what I've done. So I've done the next track. It's completely different again. It's two. I decided to make a record with just two sidelong tracks because I'd never done anything like that.
That's, yeah.
I'd never done anything like that before. And I you know, I love albums like that, you know, in a silent way, Tubular Bells.
Thick as a brick.
Any Tangerine Dream record you care to mention from it. I'd never done anything like that before. So I thought, okay, why don't I just do. So a 20-minute track and a 23.5-minute track, and that's going to be the record.
Wow.
So I'm still a little bit away from finishing it, but I think probably by the summer I'll have it finished and then maybe out early next year. And, part of this is because I haven't been able to tour the last couple of records. I wanted to tour this record until I found out that these venues are booked up for... We're talking about this with Neil backstage, my agent. Venues are booked up for 12, 18 months into the future now. So I found that to my cost a little bit too late. So we're planning now to tour. So this next record will come out, and then I'm going to do a tour basically to promote the last three records, which will be fun because it will give me a lot of repertoire to draw on.
You might have a massive Christmas hit single in the way there as well. Yeah.
It would be a nice problem to have, yeah, to wait for.
Would it, though? Would it, I mean, you know, to become the kind of noddy holder of prog rock and always have to play your Christmas single. Didn't say there's nothing wrong with it. Noddy's very grateful for Christmas every year, I can tell you that.
About 500 grand's worth of grateful,
But I mean, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? I mean, you've never been followed round by a particular... You've always moved too quickly to be followed by a particular song or a particular thing that people say you've got to... You feel obliged to...
Well, thus far, yeah. Exactly, I can't see it happening now. Joking aside, I can't see it happening now, frankly. But I mean, I've tried. You know, I've played the game. I've released singles. I've made videos. I've tried to get something going in terms of a song that would go at radio or something that would, you know, become a mainstream crossover thing. It's never happened for me. And of course, we talked about this a lot when we were doing my book, Mick. I'm kind of glad about that. I think there is, be careful what you wish for. There's an element of that, isn't there? And I'm sure Noddy Holder's happy for the with the royalty check. I mean, I have this, my best friend, one of my best friends, Nick Beggs, bass player. I mean, he still makes a lot of money from Too Shy every year.
Yeah.
But I think if you asked him, honestly, isn't that song a bit of a millstone? It kind of is for him, you know. It's you know, for many people, it's the only thing they know about him. And it's kind of come to define him in terms of the mainstream. And I think he would rather that wasn't the case. It's not a problem I have, although part of me would, I'm very torn. I would like to have a song, which is kind of something when I get into a taxi and the taxi driver says, what do you do for a living there, mate? So I mean, anything I'd know.
Yeah.
Nope. Nick can say, you'd know Too Shy, you know. So I don't have anything like that. And I think on balance, I'm happy that I don't have a song like that. Yeah.
These sidelong tracks, are they literally one piece aside, or do they? I mean, like Dark Side of the Moon, you could argue is one seamless piece of music, but obviously they fall into tracks.
So we're talking sort of side two of Abbey Road type thing, aren't we? I mean, I suppose it's kind of between the two. There are individual pieces that could stand alone, but at the same time, there are themes that come back, recur in later parts of the track from earlier in the track. So there is some sense of trying to create some sense of arc, without wishing to sound too pretentious, to the composition. Otherwise, it's just literally stringing, which is something that drives me crazy about what I think of as very lazy prog rock, is just a load of ideas that couldn't possibly stand up on their own, strung together in an effort to give it some conceptual weight.
Yeah.
Or it's a 23-minute long track. It's just a load of bits that aren't very good strung together, isn't it? But that's the beautiful thing about the Close to the Edge. It's a brilliant pop song, first and foremost. But it's also a brilliantly constructed suite which has callbacks, thematic callbacks, to earlier parts of the song. That is the brilliant thing about when something... So I'm not suggesting what I'm doing is on that level, but at least it's aspiring to be on that level.
Sounds fantastic.
It does. But, okay, so the other thing, I suppose, when you think of the name Stephen Wilson, and we touched on this earlier, and I know this is the bit of the show everyone's waiting for.
The Marillion question.
No, not yet, no. The
Rush question?
No, don't you start. There isn't any. the remixed by Stephen Wilson question.
Right.
I have a vision that a record company gets on the phone, Jethro Tull's record company, for argument's sake, and they say, let's get Stephen Wilson to remix the catalogue. And you're at home one day and a truck pulls up down the drive past the sheds and the studio, and out comes the Jethro Tull back catalogue. And you do something. I mean, I don't... First of all, I suppose I'm saying, is that what happens? And then are there ever any that you just kind of miss over and you think, well... You know, not Stormwatch probably isn't worth doing that much too.
So let me get this right. So your vision is a truck pulls up with about with about 300 2-inch multi-track tapes.
Well, I don't know what they are. I mean, I thought it's all supposed clearly. To be one tape by the end.
Okay, so let me tell you that. So, well, you're not...
Way lean forward then. Let me tell you something. Yeah. What remixing is.
You're going to get schooled now. You're going to get schooled.
I was like, what did you do? Schooled him, Stephen. In remixing by Stephen Wilson.
Yeah, he's an idiot, Stephen. I apologise. You know.
Just listen to me, all right? I'll put you right. Okay, no, actually, joking aside, you're not a million miles away. The only difference really is that I don't get the physical tapes. They're handled by a professional people. In fact, there's one of them sitting right in the front row here, Jason, who does this gentleman here. Jason works for Universal. Jason's job is essentially to take the original analog tapes and transfer them to digital. Yeah, and he does a brilliant job, and there is a real art to it, which
getting heckled. It's being heckled for transferring.
Jason's being heckled.
A member of the audience is heckling another member of the audience. Now,
this is the section that would come alive, the remix section. Well, that's what they want to hear, Steve.
Let's see. So basically, what Jason, there's this whole sort of act of necromancy there that I don't understand, black magic of getting this stuff transferred. So I get files that have already been transferred to digital, files, but I get the raw multi-track tapes, So I get a 24-track tape or a 16-track tape or a 48-track tape, whatever it is that was recorded on, and I get all of the individual instrument components that are on each of those tracks, and I have to rebuild the mix from those digital files. And I have to apply all the EQ, all the compression, all the processing, like adding reverb, echo effects, phasing effects, all of the stuff that they did when they mixed it originally in the studio. So when I do that, I'm essentially doing that with constant reference to the original stereo mix, because I believe very, very firmly that the original decisions made by the original mixing engineer should be respected, because people have been listening to these records for 40, 50 years, to which you might say, well, what's the point? Well, the point is that you can find a little bit of extra clarity these days using digital tools. And also, my job is essentially to create a spatial, for the first time, a 5.1 or a Dolby Atmos mix. But my first step is always to recreate the stereo mix as closely as possible from the original multi-track tapes. And that's not easy. That's not easy. There's a lot of detective work.
You've got a lot of approval for your...
Aqualung sounds better than the original mix.
Right? Yeah, so so this gentleman pointed out...
The one that actually I would say I'd listen to over the original mix.
Okay. Aqualung. Well, that's interesting. I mean, there are a few albums that I don't think were mixed that well to start with. And sometimes those are the ones I enjoy the most, because I feel like, oh, you know, I can actually do something to improve this. And so Aqualung would be one. Aqualung, famously, you know, one of the most iconic rock albums in history, was apparently mixed down onto a faulty quarter inch. Yeah, it was. And it doesn't sound.
Top end, is it?
It's very muddy, yeah. and the what people say is that perhaps it was, mixed down onto a tape machine.
Well,
that
was in studios, wasn't it, where Led Zeppelin was recorded?
I don't know, but.
God, he talks a lot, doesn't he? Blimey.
Yeah. All right, Lee. All right, Lee. Mrs. Lee, rope him in, please.
Is this Mr. Rush?
No.
Okay.
This is Lee.
Hello, Lee. No, I appreciate what you're saying, Lee, but what the point I'm making is that there's what's now commonly accepted is that it was mixed onto a faulty quarter-inch tape machine, because the original multitracks sound beautiful. So it's the mix, stereo mix that had problems. So that's a great example of where I think I did bring something else out of. And there's been a few. Thank you.
Does it make a difference, Stephen, whether you are partial to that particular artist or album, or could someone give you a record that, you know, actually it's one of your least favourites, or, you know, sometimes things rub us up the wrong way. Could you bring what you bring to a record that actually you hate?
No, I don't think I could do something I actively dislike. I mean, I've done things that I wasn't... I mean, I always used to say anything I take on, I have to be genuinely a fan of it. But I've revised that slightly to say everything I take on has to be the potential for me to become a fan of it. So, for example, I did the Guns N' Roses catalogue, as you know, and unfortunately the band didn't like the whole idea of spatial audio, so it got shelved, but I did the whole catalogue in spatial audio. I wasn't a fan. I didn't know the records. I've come out the other end a fan, particularly of the Use Your Illusion albums. Incredible. So ambitious and so experimental for a mainstream
band. You didn't piss about with November Rain, did you?
I did.
I kind of see why it hasn't come out.
Actually, that's the one track that did come out, because Axel decided he wanted to replace the sampled orchestra with a real orchestra.
Of course he did.
So they did that, and I remixed that. But it sounds very close to the original, ultimately, anyway. Yeah. But it is
But it's an interesting point. I mean, I'm joking aside, that, you know, musicians become involved with particular tracks and they become their sort of babies or whatever things. They might have fought a battle over this in the studio.
Mm.
You were, talking earlier about how funny Bad News is, that because all of those things that happen to them happen to real bands. Those arguments that all bands have about the bass level, you know, just turn it up. You know, you're actually taking that history and maybe making an alteration that was fought over or that was much loved. You can understand the sound, but you can't understand what was happening when the record was made.
Yeah, but the opposite is also true, that things that become so iconic to the people that have been listening to these records for 40, 50 years, the band didn't really even think very hard about it at the time, you know, so...
Well, the point is that you can't know. You can, unless you're talking to them and phoning them up. Or
but I am. Oh, quite often okay. I am. Oh,
that's quite interesting.
Quite often I
so
am.
So you'll get on the phone and say to Ian Anderson or whatever, he's two addresses, and say, Ian, I'm just about to mess about with, you know, Dunringle or something.
Well, certain things like, you know, the fact that tracks speed up and slow down. Right. I mean, it wasn't like they made a conscious decision to do that. And actually, if they were recording it now, that probably wouldn't happen because they'd be cutting everything to a click track. This is another reason why perhaps rock music belongs to a different era when bands got in. And I heard you talking about this in the first half. Bands went into a studio and cut a backing track live without any click track. They were their own click track. So that natural push and pull, speeding up, slowing down, which you hear all over these records from the 70s. And then as you move through the 80s, they start cutting things to time code and click tracks. And so the tempo has become more consistent. But something is lost also.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the bands themselves couldn't wait to get away from the speeding up and slowing down thing. They hated it. They hated the fact that they were speeding. But now, of course, we value those things. It's the same reason why some of the most popular plugins now, plugins I'm talking about, computer things that process sound, are things that put back things like tape hiss and warble and distortion and vinyl noise.
Because you can't, I mean, you cannot know what was happening on that day in their lives.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's the kind of, that's almost...
They probably don't know either, do they?
Well, that's
40 years later.
They might not, but they might. I don't know, you know. I mean, probably, you know, Axl Rose might not remember as much as Steve Howe, for example. But, you know, I suppose the point is, it must be a responsibility on which you're a fan of these bands and you're sitting there with history in your hands and thinking, well, you know, do I just eradicate this little error that...
Well, so that comes back to the original point, is that although a lot of these things the bands didn't think about, they just happened, it was serendipity or whatever, they have become part of people's... I don't think it's overstating it to say it's part of some people's childhoods, you know, they grew up listening to... And this is the other point worth making, is that when I'm mixing a record by, I don't know, Tears for Fears or Jethro Tull or Guns N' Roses, whoever it is, the people that are the fans of those records know the music much better than the artist does. Much better.
Yeah.
The artist, I mean, I'm the same. I never want to listen to my records ever again. Insert your own joke here, folks. I never want to listen to my records ever again once I finish them. And I think most artists are the same. Unless they're incredibly narcissistic, you don't go back and listen to your own records. You listen to other people's records. You don't sit there and listen to your own record over and over again. But fans do. So the fans know the music much better. So if I use the wrong take of a backing vocal on the third verse of a song on tracks two of side two, the artist isn't going to spot it. I haven't spotted it. The record company won't spot it. The manager hasn't spotted it. The moment it lands and the Amazon copies get shipped out, you can bet your ass somebody's going to go on a forum and say, I can't believe it. He's used the wrong take of the backing vocal on the third verse of the second chorus of the track two on side three. One star!
It's
happened to me so many times.
When we launched Classic Rock magazine, you know, part of the trip, as it were, was to go back in 1973 at a certain festival or an album, and we would get... If we got the tiniest detail wrong...
Mm.
And it wouldn't even be significant to anybody but the people that were there or were really concerned.
Mm.
And we would get people writing letters, often in green ink, and then certain paragraphs in red ink. And it would always be, you know, I think you said it was a Tuesday.
Right.
I think you'll find it was a Wednesday. Are you going to print a retraction?
Right. Well, these are the kind of people for whom the internet was invented. You know, these kind of forums, you know. And I think that one of the things that you have to acknowledge sometimes is that... Like, I'll give you another anecdote here. Sometimes the artist will ask me to fix things and change things that they weren't happy about at the time. Now, one artist who will remain nameless asked me to change the tempo. I'm talking about an album here. 50-year-old album, which had sold millions of copies, which was iconic, considered a masterpiece, said to me, we always played that too slow. Can you speed it up? And I had this argument with him. I said, no, you can't do that, Bob Greg, whatever his name was. You can't do that because this music, and it sounds, you know, it sounds kind of romantic notion in a way, but the music doesn't belong to you anymore. It belongs to the people that love the record.
I'll give you another example. Yeah. Kevin Shirley told me that when he was... I don't even know if it's... we'll get on to this, because I don't know what the difference is. So, I don't know, remixing, remastering, I don't know. But he took the Led Zeppelin live album, The Song Remains the Same, which was, to be honest, not that great single LP, missed out a lot of the great tracks, turned it into a double CD in 2003. And he said while he was mixing it, the original tapes or whatever he may have done to them, he said Robert came in the studio and was listening to stuff, and he almost begged Kevin to take out the baby on certain tracks.
Right.
And Kevin's like, you can't do
that's
that, Robert.
The beat.
Exactly. Yeah.
You can't. So in the end, they had to compromise and agree on how many babies Kevin would leave in there.
Right.
Could you not keep Robert happy.
Could you not just do a version, like you could have done a version and just sent it back to Bob or Greg or whatever his name was, and he would have been none the wiser. You could have just done a sped up version for him and then not put it on the actual album that goes in the shops.
I could.
This is a new idea here.
Yeah.
I think you could do
interesting.
That.
Yeah. I mean, I think, so in that situation, I kind of just argued with him and I refused in the end. I said, I'm sorry, Tarquin, I can't do it. And I explained it, the reasons. I think he understood, you know, but this is the point I'm making in a way, that a lot of the things that become sacred to the listener were actually not things that the band pored over or thought about or kind of tortured themselves making a decision, you know, just did it very quickly, very randomly. But it becomes then part of history. It becomes iconic. It becomes it becomes this sacred text. And if the album sells millions of copies, even more so. So I think all of these things are kind of going around my head when I'm working on these tracks. Yes, I could tune out of tune notes. I could do that. I can fix squeaky bass pedal sound. I can do that. I can do all that stuff. But I don't, as a rule, with a few exceptions, I don't do those things. I keep all those things because they've become a part of the fabric of what people know. You know, literally part of people's childhood.
Has it ever sort of happened the other way around where they, you know, someone's been remixed just because the record company has asked and they've sort of become resentful of, you know, you're a bit like a plumber who comes around and goes,
yeah,
well,
most
that last guy was no good.
Most of the American bands, because what happens in America is that the record company hire me to do it and they don't tell the artist.
Yeah.
I've had that a few times. I always say to the record company, I would really like it if at least somebody from the band is actively involved in this and on side with this. Because a lot of the time, they don't have to get the artist involved. The artist, essentially, on paper, has no rights because they've signed it. But it makes the whole situation much more pleasurable if the artist is on. I mean, that was the problem with the Guns N' Roses thing. I did the job because the company hired me to, but they hadn't, I found to my cost afterwards, they hadn't really got the band on board. And so I think there was and of course, there's all sorts of politics in the band itself anyway. It's just because one guy wants to do it, the other guy will go out of his way to not want to do it. So there's that stuff too. I don't envy the record companies having to play politics with some of these bands.
How would you feel, Stephen, if one day... I
know what you're going to ask.
Yeah.
Yeah. And would I like it done to me?
Well,
no.
Stephen, we just got a so-and-so. He's remixed the whole Porcupine Tree catalogue. Isn't that amazing?
No. I would... Yeah, absolutely.
But he fixed all the mistakes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not saying there were lots of... I'm just,
no,
you know.
Listen, I get it. I totally get it. I would hate that if somebody came to me. And I've, you know, one of the things I've done over the years, I've had to get people on side. So the first time I mixed King Crimson, we had to get Robert over to listen to stuff and Andy Partridge from XTC. They were all sceptical to start with. And I think I've been pretty good at getting those people on side because I think they understand... I think this is the difference with me. They know I'm also a musician. So I'm not doing this because it's my job. I'm also a musician. I could take it or leave it, this other stuff I do. I do it because I like doing it. If you don't want me to do it, that's fine. I've got my career over here anyway. And I think once they figure that out and they realise that, they understand that I come to it with the musician's perspective. And I'm not going to just do, I'm not a Jobsworth, you know.
We invited some of the, all of the readers we invited to submit their own questions. And we'll get on to that. But while we're here, there's one question a certain reader asked. Okay. And he said, for ordinary humans, what is the difference between I remixed the album and I remastered the album?
Okay.
See, I've got to murmur that question. Mm. Everyone wants to know.
It drives me crazy when people describe what I do as remastering. Very, very, very simply, remastering is taking an existing stereo mix, so you can't change the levels of any of the instruments, you can't change the reverbs, the stereo positioning, the EQ, and you, well, that's the only thing you can do, is you can EQ it a little bit, make it a bit more trebly, a bit more bassy, but it's the same stereo mix you've always had, for better or worse.
Right.
Remixing is going back to the original multi-tracks where you had the bass drum on one channel, the rhythm guitar on another channel, the bass guitar, et cetera, et cetera. And rebuilding the mix from those building blocks up. And that gives you much more, it's obviously a lot harder job as well, that gives you much more scope to get better clarity, to clean up just things like tape hiss, you know, all those things. Does that make sense?
Yeah, very much so.
So remastering is just to take an existing stereo mix, put a bit of top end on it, a bit of bass on it, there you go, compress it a bit. Remixing is to go back to all of the individual instrument overdubs, re-kind of balance them, add the reverbs back in, add the EQ, all that stuff.
So, John...
Did you get it now?
Yeah.
So, do you think sometimes it just never gets done? Because you get these, you know, oh, the whole catalogue's just been remastered and buy it again on CD with these extra tracks. It's just a marketing ploy, essentially. But do you ever hear an album and you think, I don't know if they've actually done anything to that?
Yeah, for sure. I think, interestingly enough, there's a trend now back towards... Somebody shouted out flat transfer earlier on. I think what the real audiophiles like now is to hear the original stereo mix without mastering engineers adding lots of top end and bass and compressing it. They like to hear the completely dynamic flat transfer, exactly what the band were hearing when it left the studio, which is interesting development, because there was a probably everyone has heard about this trend for brick walling, you know, making everything louder than everything else. Flattening out the dynamics of music so that the quiet bits are as loud as the loud bits. And the trend is away from that now. It's back towards more dynamic. And I obviously like that. Yeah.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Right, John, do you have one of your questions?
No, I don't. It's not much comedy so far. I thought this was a comedy.
It's over to you.
Oh, over to me, right. Yeah. Stephen, could you lift up your feet for me?
Yes, I'm wearing shoes. Yeah, that's your
question. Show them. Show them. They won't believe you otherwise.
Yes. Yeah.
Camouflage. Get them off.
Yeah. takes ages to get these shoes on and off, actually.
And we've even got a rug.
You have.
You know, because you like a rug, don't you? You like a rug.
I do like a nice rug, yeah.
On stage,
I mean. It's a very nice rug, yeah.
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 I mean, you carry your own rug around on the road.
It has its own flight case and everything, yeah.
but the shoes... The shoes don't come on stage with you.
No.
Is that a Sandy Shore influence or?
No.
That's for older readers.
Yeah, it's...
Sandy.
Well, she used to come on stage with no shoes.
She did, yes. No, it's, you know, it's not something I ever thought particularly about. I wasn't trying to make some kind of statement. I've always felt more comfortable without my bare feet anyway, even at home. And where would you like to feel the most comfortable? Where you'd like to feel comfortable when you're on stage? And also, operating my foot pedals. I have a lot of foot pedals. And with shoes, I always end up pressing the wrong button. So
Right. Yeah. Right. Have you ever considered shag pile on stage?
That's the first time I've ever been on. no, I haven't.
Because that's very comfy. You know, right. Your feet sink in and keeps you warm.
It's too comfortable on stage.
Oh, okay, yeah. You want to stay on the edge.
A little bit of edge, you know, yeah.
Yeah, cool.
But John. Do you wear them to remix?
No, I don't. Okay. Because I don't wear shoes in the studio. I don't wear shoes at home. We have a no-shoe household anyway.
Really?
Yeah.
But is that a no-sock rule as well?
Yeah.
Well...
What about slippers?
This is important, isn't it?
Because honestly, Stephen, the first time I came to visit you, I actually bought a brand new pair of slippers to wear them in your house.
Right. Did I allow you to wear them in the house? I think I did, didn't I?
No, you said, don't be silly, just keep your shoes on.
Did I?
Like, yeah, and I was like, but I've got my slippers. I stood there with my slippers in my hands. And you went, nah, we're going out again in a minute anyway.
Oh, well, that's why. There's the caveat then. So I knew we were going out again.
Right.
If you'd been coming into my studio, I would have definitely said, knock yourself out, put your slippers on. Yeah.
But you yourself are not a slipper man.
I'm not a slipper man, no. There's a prog rock joke in there somewhere, isn't there? I'm not a slipper man, no.
Okay, cool. John.
No, I think you should go with
this. Carry this on.
It's an important line of questioning you're going down here.
Well, no, listen, when I...
I think you should go to the reader question.
Oh, okay, hang on. They're on here. I'll have to check. Keep talking, John. Seamlessly cover for me while I do this.
I could go... No, I won't go to any...
Why don't you ask your Marillion question? Right, just get it over with.
He's dying to, Stephen. He's got about three of them.
Nick Wall wrote this book with you, and he very... kindly gave me a copy last week, and when he gave it to me, I said, Stephen Wilson, you know what I do know about him is that he was at the first ever Marillion gig. And Mick Wall goes, was he?
He said no, he wasn't.
He said no, he wasn't.
I've written a few more books since then, so I didn't have precise memory.
I went home and read the book, and it says quite clearly that you were at the first, that's how much attention...
It says quite clearly, does it, John?
And I thought, are there elements of this book that Mick Wall didn't touch? That's one part of the question. And the other part, more important part of the question is, the first Marillion gig, what was it like?
Okay, so it's in the book, all right, but for the benefit of the people who haven't read the book, the story goes like this, is that I was 12 years old, and I was brought up in a town called Hemel Hempstead. And the next town across from Hempstead is called Berkhamsted. Mm. And me and my friends used to go and see local bands playing at the Berkhamsted Town Hall. One of the bands we really liked was a band called the Chiltern Volcanoes, who were a punk band. And one day...
That's a great name.
Chiltern Volcanoes, yeah. One day we went along to see the Chiltern Volcanoes and we were told they were opening for a band called Marilyn. Not to be confused with the Boy George acolyte. Anyway... Yeah. We went along, and we didn't know anything about this band, Marilyn. We saw the Chiltern Volcanoes, and then Marilyn came on. And at the time, I was into the new wave of British heavy metal and all that sort of stuff.
Who wasn't?
And, yeah, I mean, exactly. Yeah. Quite a lot of people, John, but anyway. So
I was expecting at least someone. At least,
Okay.
I was into Praying Mantis or someone.
I was into it. First Diamond Head, the white label Diamond Head album was my favorite. Anyway.
That was the good one.
Yeah. But I'd also been growing up hearing my parents' record collection. So my dad used to listen to Dark Side of the Moon, Tubular Bells. My mum used to listen to Saturday Night Fever and the Donna Summer track. So I loved all this music too. But I never thought I would see any band play that kind of music in my neighbourhood, whatever that kind of music is, until I saw Marilyn that night. And what happened is after the Chiltern Volcanoes played, 90% of the audience left.
Right, okay. So describe the venue. The venue was a pub or a...
No, it was like a village hall type vibe. Yeah. And there was about 20 of us left, including some punks who basically gave a lot of abuse throughout the whole performance of Marillion.
Did they gob on them?
I don't remember gobbing on them, but they certainly weren't very happy with it. Anyway, but me and my friends were completely blown away. You know, it was amazing.
Was this pre-Fish?
This is their first ever gig. This is the first time Rothers played on stage with them. It's March 1980. I don't remember specifically what they did, but I just remember being knocked out by it. Just the idea that people would go play that kind of music in 1980, was for us as 12-year-old kids, we'd never imagine we would see that.
And did that spark a journey into listening to
it? Did
progressive rock and more experimental music?
Yeah, so we started going to see Marillion, and then we found this other band.
You discovered they weren't called Marillion.
They weren't called Marillion. Yeah, so they handed out a flyer at the gig. So we wrote it called Marillion. We started to go and see other bands, and there, for some reason, local to us, there were a whole bunch of bands. There was a band called Solstice.
Yeah, but that was the area, wasn't it? You know,
it was,
and all of
yeah.
They were that was the prog rock heart bands, really.
And there was a pub called The Wheat Sheaf in Dunstable, all these bands. And then about 2 years later, me and my mates formed this band called Karma, who were completely influenced by that sort of neo-prog sound and style. And we were about 14, 15-year-old kids, and we were doing gigs in these pubs where we weren't even old enough to drink. So, yeah, it really did. It really had a big impact.
Well, it was a thing for a while, that, you know, new wave of British prog, or whatever. It never came out as good an acronym as the new Wobham. But, as you say, I always used to think they all compared to their sort of... So Solstice was sort of like Jethro Tull. Marillion were Genesis, Twelfth Night were Pink Floyd.
I don't know about that. I think I understand. They were all very different. I think the one thing they all had in common, and I think this can't be understated, is that the first generation of progressive rock bands were influenced by other forms of music. So they were creating hybrids.
Yeah.
They were creating
classical
hybrids.
Music as well.
Classical music. So Jethro Tull, blues, folk. Genesis, sort of choral music and folk music. Pink Floyd, the blues, space rock, psychedelic music. And it's all about creating new hybrids. The second generation, or the neo-prog generation, probably the third generation by then, was all about just taking those blueprints. So it was by definition a much more limited kind of musical vocabulary, if that makes sense. And actually, when I listen to...
It's a bit like the AI, to bring it in a circular fashion. Well, all they're doing is pumping out what they've been put in.
But this comes back to the beginning of our conversation. None of these bands had... apart from Marillion, who, when they signed to EMI, none of them had budgets to go and make the records in the big studios. So they were making demos on four-track Porter studios. And they, you know, they had that kind of post-punk DIY kind of aesthetic going on, which none of the original bands had. And when you listen back to it now, it's some of the 12th Night, for example, is quite it's quite post-punky in a way.
Yeah,
it owes as much.
They used to call themselves Punk Floyd. That was
that kind of Punk Floyd.
I didn't know that, but
I quite
that
like
makes
that.
Sense to
but
me.
But they came from Reading, which is just up the road from me, so they were like the local heroes.
Yeah,
12th Night. They were, and there was a for a while they're kind of dueling with Marillion, because you know, Marillion were the first to get a record deal, but it was all like, oh, 12th Night almost got signed.
Right.
And they almost... But sadly, there's a singer called Jeff Mann, who you probably remember.
I do, yeah.
He was kind of the Fish equivalent.
Right.
And he would be a bit theatrical and stuff, but he left to go and become a vicar. And
yes, I do remember that.
Yeah.
But I think that none of these bands had anyone that was classically... Not like, Kerry Mannear from Gentle Giant, for example, studied, you know, classical music for four. He was an extraordinary musician, you know, none of these bands had that kind of training, so the music is actually quite simple in a way, but it has all the gestures of, you know, grand, progressive, conceptual. And I think that's interesting. I heard you talking about Kay Lee in the first half. I think that's why Marillion really crossed over. It's actually Marillion are a pop band at the end of the day. They don't have any of the... And all the better for it. They don't have any of the complexity. People always used to compare them to Genesis. But bless them, you know, when they ripped off the da 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 da, you know,
that Grendel,
Apocalypse
in 9/8.
So Genesis actually did it in 9/8. Yeah. Marillion did it in 4/4.
Well, you could clean if you remixed it, you could sort that out.
Yeah, add an extra bar in. Yeah, add the extra beat in. Yeah. So it was kind of it was by definition a much more kind of punk.
I get that because it was more a sort of flourish every now and again, or a lyrical reference or something like that. But
and I like that, and it's all a bit secondhand, and you know, in a bit second rate, but in a way that I love. You know, because it's my music.
It was our kind of, you know, I suppose we're maybe roughly the same age. It was that thing of, these are our bands. I couldn't see Gabriel had left. You know, Gabriel wouldn't rejoin Genesis.
You see, we didn't even know that stuff. Yeah. I didn't even know that stuff, you know. Genesis I never heard until years and years later, and I probably at the point where it was too late for me to get into that stuff. I'd grown up with Floyd, my dad, and Mike Oldfield, my dad again, and bands like Hawkwind, you know, I remember hearing through my best friend's record collection. But the more flowery prog rock I didn't hear until much, much later on. And I was more into kraut rock and things like that by that time. And it's interesting because now we have a third and fourth and fifth and sixth generation of prog rock. And each one becomes slightly more reductive. So now you have a whole generation of bands that are influenced by Marillion.
Yeah.
So Marillion, by definition, had a more limited kind of scope in terms of what they were influenced by the first generation of prog rock bands. Now you have a generation of prog rock bands that are influenced by the second and third generation. Do you see what I'm saying?
Absolutely, yeah.
So it becomes and it's the same with all genres of music. I just know prog is more my thing, so I know more about it, but I'm sure it's also true of punk and, you know, all that it becomes gradually more reductive and the pool becomes much smaller in terms of where you draw your inspiration.
And is it
from.
Do you think prog rock, the kind we're talking about right now, is it an English, I mean, or British, because it was Scottish bands as well, is it a British thing? You know, there's because that peculiar kind, I mean, Genesis or Floyd, there's that, you know, 10 years got behind you. What is it? Something is the English way. You know.
Desperation.
Yeah. And Genesis always sounded very almost medieval on selling England by the pound. And
it's funny, isn't it? Historically, that is true. I mean, I was having this discussion with an American journalist a few years ago, and he said, well, we had American prog rock bands as well. I said, okay, if you were going to make a list of the top 10 progressive rock artists, let's be honest, 8 of them would be English, 1 of them would be Canadian, and 1 of them would be American.
Well, who's the Canadian?
He wants you to say Rush. Saga. Don't say Rush.
Saga. No. I loved Saga.
Never even heard them. Never heard them anyway. It was just a gag. American Frank Zappa, Rush. The other 8 would be English. I don't know why, except I refer you back to that whole thing about perhaps something coming from the tradition of choral, you know, English choral music.
Yeah.
Counter. I don't know.
But is that why you think it wouldn't necessarily translate? But then again, I suppose yes, we're huge.
Well, the Americans love prog rock a lot more than the British do.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, those bands are still massive in America. Yes, can still tour big theaters in America.
Yeah.
A lot of these bands can. I think. And then there's a whole generation of American bands which are kind of progressive in name, but it's more to do with the sort of progressive metal bands like Dream Theater.
Yeah.
So they've kind of combined it with and also there's that kind of FM, American FM, AOR rock sensibility in a lot of, which I personally, it doesn't appeal to me. So I hear that in a lot of those American so-called progressive bands.
Did you ever hear that band Griffon?
Yes.
Griffon.
They played like crumb horns and things, didn't they?
They did.
Yeah.
Well, we used to know the drummer, didn't we?
Dave Overly.
He ended up being the ads manager on Kerrang years later. But he told me a great story once in the early 70s, before everything became marketable and niche. Mm. And they opened for Stevie Wonder at Madison Square Garden. Yeah. And they would wear, like, you know, frock coats and... What did you say? They had the frugal horns or something.
Crumb horns. Like a medieval. Sort of pre-trumpet.
Right.
Trumpet or something. I don't know, something so vaguely related to the trumpet, but like a pre-ancestor or whatever it's called, yeah.
So this is Stevie Wonder in his superstition,
higher
ground, living for the city.
That's brilliant.
Peak, right? And they come on stage. Well, you welcome from the UK, Griffon! And... applause, and they come on looking like Monty Python, you know.
Yeah.
And he said the whole audience, which was almost entirely black, were like this. And
that's
he said
brilliant.
he said they did the whole set,
and
it was like crickets. There were not any applause, not even like get off your rubbish. Just he said until
And maybe it was a crumb horn. I was going to say it was a piccolo or something. Something.
Right, pixie phone
that
or something.
Thing
that
you, you know.
Yeah, yeah, flute. Piccolo, yeah.
He said they had their guy, that one of their woodwind guys, came out and did a solo on the piccolo. And he said he kind of got carried away and he got more and more frenzied and more and more frenzied. And Dave's joining in on the drum. And finally they get to the end and they kind of do a big finish. And he said they got a standing ovation. They loved it. The crowd went insane.
Brilliant. Yeah, this is Dave Obley telling
you.
Oh,
yeah. He may have been... There may have been some... Yeah, in the actuality, they probably were just...
It's a good story, though. Mm. You don't get those kind of bills anymore. I mean, you know, I remember, you know, I've heard about, you know, late 60s, early 70s, Miles Davis would go and play at the Fillmore and he'd be opening for like Black Oak, Arkansas or something. You get this bizarre kind of, you know, cross-genre bills. You don't get those anymore, do you? I suppose you do at festivals.
Mm. Not like you used
to. Taylor Swift 1 minute, Metallica the next. Well, maybe not, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to switch to another reader question, Stephen. Yes. This is from Gary, actually two readers, because Gary asks a question and then Alexander joins in. So Gary asks, Stephen, is there a band you absolutely wouldn't remix?
For what reason?
Well, then Alexander chipped in and said he wouldn't do the Foo Fighters.
Well, okay, I'm not a fan of the Foo Fighters. I'm not a fan, to be honest.
I didn't know any of this.
Okay, I'm not really a fan. It's very unfair because I'm grasping to make a point, I'll pick on someone, okay? And to me, Foo Fighters, at the time I made this particular quote, represented everything that I wasn't interested in about mainstream rock music. And I said, well, you know, there are certain albums... I have to have some affinity with what I'm doing. I don't imagine I would have any affinity with mixing. Do you know what? I know nothing about Foo Fighters. I don't know. I just picked them because they seem to be the most ubiquitous and most famous mainstream rock band. And I kind of, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking they're probably a lot more interesting than I think they are.
In fact, Stephen.
Yeah.
Tonight.
Yes, right. Yeah.
In the wings. Yeah. Will you welcome Dave Grohl?
Well, everyone tells me he's a lovely guy and he's really and I hear they've done a disco record. Anyway, at the time I made this quote, they kind of represented everything to me that was kind of corporate mainstream rock. This is a few years ago. So is there anything I wouldn't mix? I think I'd have to have some interest musically. But as we've already established, there are things that I don't necessarily think I'm going to like, and then I can grow to like them. So there's probably nothing on principle I wouldn't at least look at. Is there... Is there anything I really hate unequivocally? I don't know. I don't think I'm very open-minded, you know.
Motley Crue?
No. I read that book. It's hilarious. I couldn't name you a single song of theirs, you know.
The guitarist is a big favourite of this pod.
Right.
Mick Mars. The deep.
Right.
What's his name?
Okay.
Dealer.
No,
the
I
dealer.
Know all about him. He's got some... Bone things.
Yeah,
so he's in pain the whole time. I've read the book. I thought it was brilliant. Brilliant. No interest in going and listening to the music at all, as yet. But, you know, maybe I would like. Well, maybe so.
John.
Yes.
You have other questions.
I've done two. I did the other one, but it was about Marillion. He said to me, ask me more than one question about Marillion...
I said you can have one question about Marillion.
And I believe I've had it.
Okay.
You have, yeah. You've done your... But Mick could ask...
Well, I've got one final question from the readers, which I'm going to save for the end.
Okay.
But before... Because we are coming to the end, sadly. No!
No!
We're just getting rid of him. I'll stay.
No!
Wow.
What's your question? Go on.
Oh, no, it's a reader question.
A reader's question,
yeah.
Okay.
No, I was going to ask you first before we do that. You told us kind of what your plans are and all the rest of it. We have to ask about Porcupine Tree. Now, one of the great pleasures I've had as an author, most of my books torment me, but when I worked with you on your book, it was fantastic because I was actually working with someone who was a writer. That hasn't happened to me before working with rock musicians. And I just wondered if, is there in the future other books you want to do? I know you're good on short stories. Would you also at some point consider, I know you don't like the conventional biography, which is good, but would you consider something that was a bit more Porcupine Tree centric, as it were?
I think those books have been written. I haven't read any of them, but there's been a very flatteringly, there's been a couple of books already about Porcupine Tree. I don't know how you could write a book about that band without it crossing over into everything else. That's the Porcupine Tree, as I'm sure most people know, started as a solo project anyway. So it's very hard for me to, I can't imagine just writing a book about that is kind of what I'm grasping to say here. But maybe somebody else could and probably have. In fact, they have.
Do you know what I think? Is there not a sort of Porcupine Tree universe, if you know what I mean, in which not you exist as a character? Because I'm thinking now of kind of fan fiction or something like that, which is a very odd concept, but it's interesting in that you exist as you, but you also exist in people's imaginations as something completely different. Only they really know what that is. And Porcupine Tree does that. It's one of those bands, as you say, it's in the tradition of bands that send you into these, you know, something that's quite like a private universe almost.
I think we have a sound. We have a sound which only now I can appreciate, actually. In fact, I only really appreciated that we had this sound when we came back. And I'm like, and I can hear all these bands that kind of have, you know, been influenced by what we did, which essentially, if I could try and, you know, characterize or encapsulate it, was taking classic songwriting with metal kind of tropes and a kind of ambient sound design approach as well, which is mostly Richard, and Gavin's very polyrhythmic drumming and my melancholic kind of songwriting. And when you put those things together, there is something quite unique about that sound, which is I now understand and recognise as being the sound of Porcupine Tree. And I can hear it in lots of other bands. Again, very flatteringly, I can hear it in lots of bands that have kind of picked up on that. But at the time, I wasn't necessarily aware that we had our own sound, and now I am. So I understand what you're saying. There is a Porcupine Tree universe. But for example, I don't write, historically, I didn't write music specifically, you know, to be Porcupine Tree music. And in fact, a lot of songs I've written for Porcupine Tree ended up on my solo records and vice versa. So it's a little bit less easy for me to be in just that one, certainly in terms of writing a book or writing something about just that one little part of my life. I think I would find that quite difficult from the inside, if you see what I mean.
We're going to end, excuse me, we're going to end with one final reader question. It's a quick fire, Stephen.
Okay, go on.
To end the show.
Yeah.
It's yes or no with a bit of elaboration if you want.
Okay.
Ready?
Yes.
Pink Floyd or King Crimson?
Well,
oh, by the way, this is from James Johnson.
I can't do these as yes and no, because I have to be able to qualify what I say.
Feel free.
Thank you. Okay. Pink Floyd, because they are and have always been my favourite band. King Crimson are incredible and I love them, but Floyd is my Beatles. Floyd is my Beatle. I never particularly was that inspired by the Beatles. Floyd were my Beatles.
Genesis or Jethro Tull?
Jethro Tull. But only. Well, I'm not so familiar with Genesis. So let me qualify this. I do like Genesis albums. Somehow I've got this reputation that I don't like Genesis. I do quite like Genesis. When I was growing up, my best friend loved Genesis and I loved Pink Floyd, and it was a bit never the twain shall meet. I tried to get him into Floyd and he tried to get me into Genesis. I like Genesis. I actually controversially really like the pop era of Genesis.
Boo.
Yeah.
Wow.
I love Duke, and Then There Were Three. They're probably my two favourite.
Then There Were Three is a great
They're probably
record.
My that's two I favourite Genesis records.
I wouldn't say Then There Were Three is the pop era.
That well, it is, later. Isn't it? They're writing pop songs on that record. No, okay. Anyway, yeah. I really like those two records.
I think you should do it because they seem to be a strong Genesis. Was that more Genesis than Jethro Tull? So, well, so defend Jethro Tull. Never mind.
I love Jethro Tull. I would say that Ian Anderson, possibly the single most gifted individual the progressive rock world has ever thrown up.
Okay.
This is a guy, wrote the songs, could play guitar, could play flute, could sing.
Could produce, stand on one leg.
Could stand on one leg and play the flute. Even ended up playing bass on some of their records. I mean, and as I've been remixing their catalogue, I've realised just how prolific he was as a songwriter. Yeah. Every album, every year, single-handedly wrote it, and there's usually at least another album's worth of great material left over, which has been one of the gifts to actually remixing their catalogue, is discovering all these songs that were just left on. Incredible. I'm in awe of his talent and how prolific he was. Genesis were a collective. There are some things I like about Genesis. It's just not ingrained in me the way that some of the other bands are.
Yeah. No, that's a fair point. I read a great thing about
I've heard The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway.
You've heard it.
I've heard it. It's not rubbish. I've heard Foxtrot. I've heard it.
All right, Lee. Mrs. Lee. Mrs. Lee, put the budgie cover
Being
over.
Being heckled for not having listened to various Genesis albums.
Right. It's good. Yeah. No, can I just say one more thing about this? Sorry, I know we're over. One more thing about this. Part of me, it's in my nature also to love winding up the prog rock fundamentalists.
Well, you're in the right place.
I fucking love winding them up.
But they're so hard to wind up, aren't they?
So easy. So on occasion, and it's almost like if you like progressive rock, it's almost like you're expected to treat the Genesis catalogue as if it's some kind of... So I've taken great delight in telling people over the years that I fucking hate Genesis. Especially that. And actually, I don't. I quite like it. It's not in the same... It doesn't have the same sort of resonance to me as some of the other bands do. But I always thought Gentle Giant were the most underrated band of the whole scene. And I think they are up there with the top rung.
Right, Stephen. Final question. Yes. Final question. Yes. Comes from reader James Johnson. Same guy. Yes. Quick fire. Marillion or Porcupine Tree?
Well, I don't know. What in what context?
Well, you know, Pink Floyd or King Crimson, Genesis or Jethro Tull, Marillion or Porcupine Tree?
Well, I'd rather listen to a Marillion album than one of my own records. But for the aforementioned reasons, you know. Well, you're not going to draw me any further than that.
Will there be another Porcupine Tree album in the foreseeable?
No idea. Seriously, and I'm not lying this time.
No, I believe you, because you don't really approach it that way, do you?
No, I think, you know, if we were going to make another record, there'd have to be a reason for us to make another record. And when I say a reason, I mean there would have to be... I can't do more of the same. Mm. I can't do it. And I say that because actually that's what most bands spend their whole career trying to do. They find a formula that works, that people like, and then they just keep playing the same furrow. And I know you and I both agree on this. This is the whole Bowie thing. Yeah, people really love that. They fucking love that. It's done really well for me. It's been really successful and the fans all love it. Now, what can I do that's completely different? Yes. And actually, that mentality is very unusual in this industry. Most of the mentality would be, they fucking love that. Let's do more of the same. And to be fair, that's actually what most are. And I, you know, I'm not trying to come across as holier than thou, because actually it's a curse to be like that in a way.
Yeah.
So Porcupine Tree, to make another album that just sounds like another Porcupine Tree album would not interest me. So we'd have to find some way of reinventing what we do again. And that's not inconceivable, but it's harder when there's a collective. It's very easy and there's just one of you. This is why it works for Bowie, it works for Neil Young. If there's just one of you, and you say, you know what, I've done that now. I want to go and do something completely different, 180 degrees. To get a whole sort of collective of people to all move in that direction simultaneously is really hard. Somebody's going to say, no, I'm happy doing what we're doing. Can we just stick to what we're doing, please? You know, the Mike Love thing. Brian Wilson's off trying to make Smile.
Right.
Mike Love's... Can we keep writing songs about surfing and cars? That's what people like. And that's the problem with being in a band.
Yeah.
But it's also the beauty of being in a band. Is that you have this little part of the Venn diagram where you all cross over and you all agree, and that's your identity. And that's why bands tend to have a stronger identity, but reinvent themselves less than solo artists, which is why I felt I had to be a solo artist.
Well, I think we'll all agree that we're very fortunate and delighted that we have both. We have you as a solo artist, we have Porcupine Tree, and we have all these other amazing things you do as well. And long may you continue doing them. Really good luck with the next album. Can't wait to hear these sidelong tracks.
Is it anything like
Sounds Grendel? Just like Genesis and Marillion.
So,
it really doesn't.
Will you please say thank you on behalf of all of us here to Stephen and John and everybody else here that's made this such a lovely evening.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. That was fun.
Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you,
everyone. This will go out as a pod in the next week or two. Please find it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How do I stop this, Fern?